Good morning to everybody in the audience, and welcome to this special edition of Teneo Insights. We're doing things a little differently today with just one guest. He's Kwasi Kwarteng, the new Secretary of State for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy. And he's certainly got his work cut out. A common theme on these calls has been how COVID-19 has thrown so much up in the air, accelerating trends for business. We've seen decades of change in just under a year, and there's plenty more to come. Appropriately enough, given the name of our guest, many are predicting a K-shaped recovery, with some sectors cratering and others flying. The knock-on effects are enormous economically, socially, and politically. Today, we'll get to the bottom of what the Secretary of State plans to do about it, get a proper understanding of his approach and his strategy. He's hit the ground running in terms of being out there, and he's made some big decisions, including backing and funding a Blue Sky Science Agency and scrapping plans for a wide-ranging review of workers' rights. In the next hour, we'll hear his pitch to business and listen to his plans for a post-COVID and post-Brexit world. We'll try to find out about how he plans to build back better while balancing the public finances. What's the plan for net zero, and where does he stand on diversity and inclusion? Throughout the call, senior figures from business will be popping up to put their questions too. But before that, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you drag your cursor to the sidebar of the screen, you can see the chat function. Please send any questions here and I'll try to ask as many as I can. For legal reasons, I have to say if there are any journalists on this call, please hang up now. This isn't intended for broadcast or publication in any way. To Kwasi Kwarteng, thanks very much for joining us, taking the time. You're taking on the role at a fascinating time, not just with COVID, but many people think the Conservative Party's lost its grip on being the natural party of business. When Theresa May was Prime Minister, it felt like business was a bit on the naughty step. There's been the usual issues with Brexit. And when the then Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson said something stronger than screw business, slightly stronger than that, a lot of people thought things had really gone wrong. So are you here to charm us?
Well, I'm not on a charm offensive, Craig. I remember someone described, I think it was Tony Blair said, you know, Gordon and I are on a charm offensive. I do the charm, he's just offensive. I'm not on that sort of charm offensive on the porn cocktail circuit. But what I want to do is reach out to business. I think we've had a very difficult time, not only with coronavirus, but we also had, and you remember this vividly because directly involved with this. It's 5 years since the Brexit referendum was called. So we're in February 2021, and the referendum, as you remember, was called in February 2016. And for 5 years, it seemed that every day we were talking about Brexit. And this put strains on everybody. It was a binary question. I think, you know, families were divided on the issue, friends were divided on the issue, the whole country seemed to be divided on the issue. And naturally, I think it put a strain, a big strain, on the relationship between business and the government. And not only did we have the Brexit issue, we also had two general elections, one of which was very indecisive. We had 2 years of a hung parliament where nothing could be done. People talked about no deal. People talked about a second referendum. People talked about the withdrawal agreement. I was the undersecretary. I was the bill minister for the withdrawal agreement for the first time around. And we lost the vote by 200 votes, government losing the vote by 200 votes. So we've gone through an unprecedented time. And I think, actually, that this is a great opportunity because with the fact of a deal, I think we've very largely turned the page on those 5 years, I think. There are still ongoing issues, no doubt. But the way in which Brexit was dragging down not only our politics, but our economy, given the uncertainty, was something which I'm glad that we're seeing the back of. Now. Seems an irony, but just as the Brexit issue was solved, we had coronavirus come seemingly out of a clear blue sky. And as you said in your remarks, I think that has completely changed the dynamics of government intervention, government participation in the economy, if you like, government support for the economy. I remember when I came in 2010, the deficit was 160 billion, the biggest peacetime deficit we'd ever had. Now we're talking about £300 billion being spent. So that's had a transformative effect on the role of government. And then lastly, I would mention the net zero role. You know, net zero was something that didn't really even exist as a concept 10 years ago. Well, it existed as a concept, but it wasn't something that we legislated for. And of course, we led Save It Forward in 2019. A month after that, I was made energy minister, I was appointed energy minister. And a lot of the work I did as energy minister, most of it, revolved around formulating policies around net zero. So the world is a very different place to where we were 10 years ago. And that's why I think it's a new opportunity for someone like me to try and reach out and form a new relationship with business.
So is your pitch to business that you're really on side with them and that you're not going to be basically tweaking their tail in the way that Theresa May tried to?
I'll say two things about that. One is I am a free marketeer and I've been bashed on the head for this by the media. But I'm also somebody who realizes that 2021 is a different era, a different time. To the 1980s, it's a different context. I mean, we didn't know what net zero was in the 1980s. And the third thing I would say, the first thing I'd say is that I'm a free marketeer by instinct. The second thing I would say is that I think the circumstances because of Brexit, COVID, and net zero are very different from the 1980s, so we've got to accommodate that. And the third thing I would say, and I said to the Prime Minister, is that I want to be an independent, I am an independent voice around the cabinet table. I mean, you know me, Craig. I'm not someone who's going to simply just parrot lines that I've been given. In fact, I've got into trouble in my political career for being almost too frank at times. So I'm someone who's not afraid of actually representing business and key stakeholders at the highest level of government.
I'm interested in you asserting that you're still a free marketeer in this environment. I mean, a lot of people see that the government is, understandably, as all governments around the world, is borrowing hundreds of billions, injecting into the economy. It's the kind of stuff that Jeremy Corbyn could only fantasize about. And you are delivering it as a government.
No, I agree. Look, it's difficult for people sometimes to think, well, the government's intervening, so therefore they're not free market. And I get that. But actually, if you look at what's happening in the economy, if you look at what tech stocks are doing, what tech companies are doing, if you look at the fact that the internet means that you can actually have or approximate something like the law of one price. You know, you can choose a huge range of things. The markets are, in a way, are acting even more efficiently than they ever have done. The arbitrage opportunities are much lower than they ever. And I was just talking to a journalist this morning. I think the scope for actual markets through the internet, through technology, are vast. I think the opportunities for market-led progress and reform are huge. You look at the financial sector. You know, we grew up in a high street where there were four banks, and that was that. Now we've got Monzo, we've got Starling, we've got all sorts of innovative companies in this space. You know, people have made huge amounts of money in a very short time through technological advance. So on one level, you're right to say Corbyn wouldn't dream of, Corbyn, this is a paradise for Corbyn because of state intervention. But on another level, I think that's completely wrong. I think there is a huge role for markets to play in today's dynamic economy. And that's something which I'm very pleased to be promoting.
So I want to get to lots of questions from the audience, but I was interested in some research. I think it's Treasury research, which is basically suggesting that the UK has fallen more in terms of GDP than most other developed countries. I think twice as bad. And it's likely to bounce back much more slowly. Why do you think that is?
For a start, there are issues with how that is actually calculated. I think that the UK, let's be frank about this. I mean, the UK is a very consumer focused economy, a very service based economy. And of course, if you're going to have a lockdown, that will have a disproportionate impact on an economy that is very much consumption driven and has been historically. Now, there are ways that we can mitigate that and change away from that. And that's one of the key things in my agenda, the net zero leveling up agenda. That's all about investment in skills and in technology. And I think that represents a huge opportunity for us. But there's no doubt that an open economy, which relies on lots of people coming in, retail, on consumption, is going to be vulnerable to the shock of a pandemic where people essentially are being told to stay at home.
I want to come on to a lot of the things you mentioned there a bit later in the call, but let's talk a little bit about the vaccine, credit where it's due. Yeah. The government gotten for 10 million people who've got it. They're streets ahead of a lot of other countries. Can you give some sense of where you think we're going to be in H2 of this year? Just how optimistic are you? How optimistic can we be?
I'm optimistic that when we get started again, that there'll be a real pent-up demand to find expression. Impressive, I hope, economic. The reason for that is that, as you know, I mean, I think I'm my fourth week in the job, and I've spoken to more than 200 CEOs, 200 people at the various forums, I mean, excluding forums such as this one, on a bilateral basis or on a roundtable basis. And it keeps coming up again and again, particularly in sectors like retail and hospitality. You know, they are really suffering in the COVID pandemic. And I think the one thing they want is to reopen the economy. And if we can do that, and I'm hopeful that can happen sooner rather than later, but I can't tell you when. If we can do that, I think there's a really strong chance that we'll have a good recovery.
One of our clients is AstraZeneca, and we've seen the real benefits of a life sciences industry that's really pushing ahead with the vaccine. What guarantees can you give that the government is really going to make sure that life sciences is front and center going forward?
So, I mean, Craig, you ask an excellent question, and I've got an answer for you, which I hope you will be satisfied with. As a junior minister in the department, I was always slightly unclear as to where we were going in terms of innovation, what the sectors were that we wanted to innovate in. One of the first things I've done is said, look, we need to have an actual innovation strategy like the net zero strategy and the 10-point plan. But it's clear to me that areas where we are particularly strong and where we want to develop are life sciences. That's been demonstrated particularly in the vaccine development and rollout and research that underpin that. Space technology, I think, is something we've got to work out where it is in space technology we want to invest in. Battery technology. There are certain areas where I think we do have advantages, and we need to develop those. And that's one of the key priorities that I have, unleashing innovation, but through a much more rigorous approach to what it is that we actually want to innovate in.
So are you picking winners in a way? And
No. So I think we've got to distinguish between two things. I think the picking winners of the industrial strategy in the set of the 70s, for example, was very much about backing individual companies, the most famous of which in that instance, Leyland. We're not going to back individual companies, I don't think, in that way that happened in the 70s. But what we can do is give a very clear direction of the kind of sectors that we see represent British advantage. And I think that's an entirely legitimate thing for governments to do. I think every industrial country, certainly in the last 80 years, certainly since the Second World War, has had some form of interest in terms of directing or encouraging research in specific areas. So broad areas, yes, individual companies support, no, generally.
So we're going to do something unusual on this call. We're actually going to bring into vision some people who are going to ask some questions, very senior people in business. And the first is John Reed, who's the president of Live Nation. John, I'll let you introduce yourself and ask your question to the Secretary of State.
Sure, good morning. Morning, Quasi. Thanks. I'm in business for Live Nation. We're the biggest global concert promoter and ticket selling business. Obviously, we own Ticketmaster as well. Britain's creative industries faced a significant downturn in 2020 and now potentially 21. For us, it was a loss of over 80% of our business last year. What measures are the government considering, such as specifically guaranteeing cancellation insurance, some sort of back-end protection for us to support the live music industry? It's a sector we're famous around the world for. We preserve £4.5 billion of money for the UK economy, and we employ around 200,000 people in the UK. That's really our concern.
I'll be very direct on that. I mean, that actual issue is something which you will know is dealt with in a different department. So my close friend Oliver Dowden is someone who has direct responsibility for the creative industries and for concerts and sporting venues. I mean, as a constituency MP, I've got London Irish, and I'm fully aware of the fact that they've been very, very badly hit by the fact that audiences have been, crowds essentially, have been restricted for their events. I think that there is an approach that we want to obviously support. We understand that creative industries are a key part of the UK economy. I've also got Shepperton Studios in my constituency. But I'm not going to, I can't tell you exactly what it is we're going to do. And all I can do is say I'm backing British business, but this is something which I'm afraid is not my part of my portfolio. I hate to give you that answer. I'm a historian. I hate it when historians say this isn't my period. So don't ask me about it. But I'm afraid I'm going to have to say the DCMS is the place to go to on that question.
Any thoughts you'd like to add on that, John?
No, we're talking to DCMS, but business is business. I have a very pragmatic view.
We have to have a view, and we want to protect British business. But what I'm not going to do is say something about what we're going to do for a responsibility that my colleague Oliver Dowden ultimately bears in relation to your sector.
Well, thanks for asking the question, John. I'm going to bring up Claire Hawkins now, who's from Phoenix, also one of our clients. She's the Director of Corporate Affairs and Investor Relations there. Claire, you've got a question for the Secretary of State.
I have. Good morning. So Phoenix is... Can you hear me? Yes. Good morning. Phoenix Group is the UK's largest long-term savings and retirement business. I'm particularly interested in asking you today about older workers. So we've seen older workers hit particularly hard by the pandemic, with the number of over 50s claiming benefits doubling in the period from March to September of last year alone. Now, as the country recovers, it's vital that older workers are seen as an important and productive part of the UK workforce. So how can we ensure older workers are supported by businesses and government alike so they can boost productivity and growth post-COVID-19?
I think this is a really fundamental question, and actually it goes to the changing society we've talked about in terms of a higher pension age. People my generation will probably retire 67, maybe 68. And I think adapting our economy to the needs of an older workforce is a central question. There are a couple of things that I think we've done and we're doing, which aren't particularly well known. But you know, apprenticeships for older people, I know many people are engaged with that. I think we need to publicise that. DfE colleagues talk about lifelong learning. I think we need to be more full-throated about that and say that we want to adapt our aging workforce. It's not aging, I mean, it's actually more experienced workforce, so that we're adaptable in that way. And I think that in terms of skills, in terms of apprenticeships, I think we have got policies that bring older people who are more experienced, and allows them to retrain, but we need to do more in that area. The skills, apprenticeships, and being able to adapt the skills we've learned in a changing environment are absolutely crucial to that. And it's not really, I mean, obviously some resources, a clearer policy and also clearer presentation of what we're doing. But I think there's a lot of work we're doing. I mean, if you compare where we were 10 years ago, there are lots of schemes trying to bring older workers, reskill them, adapt our economy to the needs of older workers.
Claire, do you feel that there's enough moving, as the Secretary of State says?
I think that's very encouraging. Thank you very much, and we look forward to working with you.
We should pick this up. I can get back to you on what's actually happening. And again, you know, working very closely with the DfE, I set up a Green Jobs Task Force, which is exactly the kind of thing that we need to look at. If you've got a plumbing skill or you've got engineering skills, how can we adapt those skills to the net zero challenge, you know, to things like carbon capture, offshore wind, and things of that nature? And so, just on an example of that, when I was energy minister, I looked at offshore wind installations in the North Sea. And a lot of the people who were working them had worked in oil rigs in the 80s and 90s. And they'd adapted the skills they'd learned there to offshore wind. And that's exactly the kind of thing, more of that kind of thing.
So thank you very much, Claire. Kwasi, I just want to bring you on to, you know, the conflicting priorities of the government. And, you know, there's an assertion about building back better, but it often runs up against other issues. A lot of what is planned is big infrastructure projects, that kind of thing. But I remember from my time that Conservative MPs are the worst at NIMBYism. They get judicial review, stick things in the way, and, you know, and everything slows down, and roads that were going to be built take years, and if ever. Are you confident that you can actually bring your own backbenchers along to make sure that all this stuff happens?
Well, since you left Downing Street, Craig, we've had two general elections. Okay? And I can assure you the parliamentary party of today is very different to the beast that you knew and cultivated so well before 2016. I think, you know, especially with the so-called red wall seats, there's a huge appetite for investment, for infrastructure, spending, if you like. I was very heartened to see the Treasury say that we're going to have a national infrastructure bank. You know, net zero has its own huge capital demands. It's a slightly different world to where we were in 2015. But you're right. I think that there is still a challenge. It would be wrong for me to say that all our colleagues on the parliamentary benches are 100% behind all of this infrastructure spending. But I think, I definitely think the mood of the party, appetite for this.
Okay. Let me try another one on you. I hear lots of stuff about, you know, building back better. And then I hear Priti Patel basically saying she's going to clamp down on immigration. Who is going to build the houses, you know, fill the, be in the abattoirs, you know, pick the fruit, all of that kind of stuff? Seriously, it's going to be a problem, isn't it, if the economy really starts taking off? Who's actually going to do some of those lower skills?
So the whole point about building back better, one of the points, the two or three things that if you unpack the phrase building back better, that it actually means. So one of the things it means is the fact that there's going to be more geographical distribution, okay, of economic opportunity. So places like, for example, the Northeast, our old industrial heartlands, need to have more economic opportunity. That's what building back better partly means. And of course, you will remember that those places are places where there's traditionally been high unemployment. And in the Brexit vote, I hate to go back to that, they voted overwhelmingly for Brexit. In fact, it was the Sunderland vote and the Newcastle vote that were the first two votes that were announced that indicated which way the referendum was going. So I think building back better has a geographical component. It also has, it so happens with net zero, a lot of the net zero infrastructure that we want to build is in those areas in terms of the levelling up. So that's a green agenda. That's a geographic redistribution, if you like, agenda that sit together. And I don't think that the immigration debate is that relevant to those two perspectives. From my point of view, I've always wanted an open and dynamic economy. And so I'm very interested in trying to attract the best talent to the UK. And there is a debate about how you set an immigration policy to do that. But in two instances, in terms of the green agenda, and in terms of the levelling up, the geographical redistribution, for want of a better phrase, or better distribution, I don't think that tension is that relevant.
Okay. Now, Leo Quinn is the CEO of Balfour Beatty. They're one of our clients. He's not going to come into vision, but he sent in a question. And he says, Balfour Beatty and the industry more broadly are ready to answer the government's call to arms and propose ambitious new projects that will get the country moving again. My key observation, having gone through this process before, is that the government could do with someone who is specifically tasked with looking at these areas and driving them forward, and that giving industry bad news early is better than keeping us hanging on. Does the government have plans to task someone with this, maybe linked with the Project Speed team?
That's a very, very specific question. And in terms of my experience or knowledge and authority, that's clearly a number 10 prime ministerial lead. We absolutely are, though, as a department in Bayes, conscious of the fact that we're very good at coming up with policies, we're very good at coming up with regulation, and we need to be more delivery focused. And that's why my predecessor, Alok Sharma, a good friend, he essentially hired a person who's directly committed to implementing implementation and delivery. And I think, unpacking your question there, I think there's a frustration with the bureaucracy and the lengthy processes that often is associated with government, and we definitely want to speed them. As the Secretary of State debates, I've been very conscious of the fact that it takes us years sometimes to reach decisions which should be that taken in months, if not weeks.
Okay, a very hot topic among a lot of the businesses that we represent is business rates. Yeah. They're a major issue for a lot of companies, and a lot of them feel that they're sky high and that we're seeing a declining high street, and COVID has basically accelerated that. Do you have any plans to change these or enable a more level playing field? People looking at tech? Of course.
I mean, business rates obviously is a treasury issue. And I'm not absolving myself of responsibility. I mean, I remember I was PPS to Philip Hammond for a long time, actually. I think I'm the longest serving PPS to Chancellor Exchequer, at least since we came into power in 2010. And in that time, we talked about business rates a great deal. And there is an ongoing treasury business rates review. And I'm looking forward very much to its findings. I think it was suspended or delayed because of the COVID response. And clearly, treasury officials were 100% focused on dealing with COVID. But I think business rates has been flagged as an issue. It's definitely something that needs to be looked at. I mean, I'm a historian, so and I know that, I mean, these rates, these business rates, these, and the old rating system comes from Queen Elizabeth. And I'm not talking about Queen Elizabeth II, I'm talking about 400 years ago. I mean, a lot of these taxes, one of the oldest taxes, the rate system that we have. And it is time for a review. And I hear that all the time. And all the business people I speak to.
I hear you loud and clear that it's a treasury issue. But it sounds to me from what you're saying that you want to nudge them in the direction of trying to solve this problem.
I mean, the point I was trying to make about all the history, that this thing has been going on for centuries. Okay? And given the fact that we're in a very different situation, I think there is a good argument, a good cause to look at business rates and to see whether there's an alternative to them. As a matter of fact, and I remember this from my days as a bag carrier in the Treasury, effectively, it raises a huge amount of money. So if you're any chance of the Exchequer looking at business rates, is going to think, as I think I remember Philip Hammond saying, okay, if I don't have business rates, where am I going to get 25 billion, I think it was at the time, from? And so those are the kinds of conversations that we're having in the Treasury. But we were having in the Treasury, and I'm sure they're having them now. And I'm looking forward to the review, and that's something that
a lot of people, I mean, look, I know this is tricky territory for you, but a lot of people look at the news about Jeff Bezos yesterday and see the spectacular amounts of money, that the tech industry is making, that they want to see some kind of online situation. I mean, do you feel that's just an overly simplistic response?
Well, no, I mean, we again, that came up very often when Philip Hammond was the chancellor. And his answer to that would be, all that would happen is that they would pass on the costs to the consumers. And there's no evidence that sales, online sales, would go down if those taxes were simply passed on to consumers. So what you're effectively arguing, I think there's got to be a global response to this. I totally think there's a mismatch. But if you rush to put a sales tax, an online sales tax, all you could end up doing is simply taxing consumers. And the people that you want to tax simply get off scot-free, effectively.
So I want to come on to an area which is, bang in your wheelhouse. It's COP26 and net zero. You were energy minister. You were Minister for Energy just before taking on this job. And that's one of the reasons why you were promoted to be Secretary of State. We've also seen your predecessor, Alok Sharma, is going to do COP26, which is being seen, obviously, as a major priority. A lot of that, we're actually getting Alok Sharma on in a couple of weeks' time, so we'll ask him some questions there. But can we just get some sense from you about this pathway to net zero? It's sort of like talked about very widely and it's broadly accepted. We've got to get there. The government's made commitments on it. But it feels like such a gargantuan project, which is going to change so much. Can you just give us some sense of how you think we're actually going to get there? What are the big...
It sounds really boring, Craig, but I'm just going to run through the Prime Minister's 10-point plan.
Okay.
So the first thing is offshore wind. So that means that we basically can create carbon-free power. And if in 2012, and I can't remember when you came into number 10, but in 2012, which isn't that long ago, 40% of our electricity was generated by coal, essentially. Today, that's 2%, and we're going to go to zero by 2024. And what's taken the lion's share of that load has been offshore wind. So this is a hugely successful thing, and that's something which we want to develop. So that's one way where we can continue decarbonizing. The second point of the 10-point plan was hydrogen, and we think there are great opportunities for hydrogen as a decarbonized source of power. It can potentially be used in industrial processes. It could also be used in transportation, particularly heavy goods vehicles and buses, potentially trains. And also, ultimately, it may well be part of the gas network. And ironically, if you look at town gas, before we had natural gas, town gas was 50% hydrogen. So by a sort of strange coincidence, it may well be that we could go back to a largely hydrogen gas network. And there are experiments in the University of Kiel and other places which are trying to blend, in the first instance, hydrogen with natural gas. Again, so that's a decarbonized source of power. The fourth point is electric vehicles. We all know the carbon emitting qualities of the internal combustion engine. We know about diesel, and we're trying to essentially eliminate that from cars by 2030. When I first got into the job, we talked about 2040. We've accelerated that in 2030. And what was extraordinary about that, Craig, was that the only bad headlines we got were from the Daily Mail, and they lasted one day. Even manufacturers in this space are accepting the fact that we're going to be moving to electric vehicles. The fifth point was all relating to greater use of public transport and cycling and walking. And that's something which, again, is DFT, but that's something that if we can promote, we can again decarbonize. We're looking at jet zero in terms of sustainable aviation. And that's something that I'm going to be interviewing people today about the Jet Zero Council and how we can promote that. We've got, I think I'm on my seventh point, we've got a heat and building strategy, how we're going to decarbonize.
I think
you cannot have the 10-point
plan. I mean, there's lots of big plans. I get it.
Yeah, whether we execute them, yeah, you can hold us to account. Say we don't have a strategy. Policy leaders is completely the wrong. It's completely wrong. I mean, I don't think there's any leader in the world that has outlined a route and pathways to net zero and means mechanisms to get there more articulately and clearly than the Prime Minister has.
Yeah, that's fair, and I'm not being adversarial on it. I think I just want to add
three other points. You got bored of that because.
Yeah, it's not because I'm bored, it's just because I want to make sure we get through it. But it's like we're saying. I'm not saying there's a plan. I'm just trying to get to some of the detail of the plan, Kwasi.
No, so for example, people
want to buy electric vehicles, but they realize as well that you have to dig up all the roads in the country and stick. Nothing. People hear about a hydrogen economy and then hear there isn't enough hydrogen in the world to even begin to get to it. It's sort of, I think what I'm trying to get to.
Look, I mean, in politics, it's a very common question. Oh, there's no granularity. There couldn't be more granularity. Okay? There couldn't be more. And the industries love it. They say, look, this is really good. We can really get behind this. Whether we deliver or not is a different question. I think we get that. But to say that there isn't a roadmap, to say that there aren't policies, to say there aren't targets is completely wrong.
To be fair, I didn't say there wasn't a roadmap. I was just trying to get you to spell it out. But anyway, Andy Palmer. Andy Palmer is going to come up into vision now. He's the vice chairman and CEO of Switch Mobility, another one of our clients. He's got quite a specific question for you, Andy.
Secretary of State, just a little background on me. I'm 41 years in the auto industry, 23 years at Nissan, and I was chief operating officer at Nissan, and probably best known for inventing the Nissan Leaf. And then I was 6 years at Aston Martin as chief executive. Now I'm very much in the net zero space, and Switch Mobility, you may know as Optare, Basically, it's the electric version of Optare. Secretary of State, thanks for taking my question. You've said that your preferred spirit is being frank, so allow me to be quite frank. Clearly, with COP26 coming up, clean energy and electric vehicles are a sector that the government will need to support. And you've been clear on that. I think point four and point five in your 10-point plan address electric vehicles and address public transportation. Yeah, I work with a pioneering and ambitious Leeds-based electric bus and van company, which is basically called Switch. It's an auto tech company, and it's one which has India's largest vehicle manufacturer as a key investor. So it fits in that auto tech space. It's well funded, and it's very much with the mission of net zero. All good. But yet, I'm having to consider seriously moving the company and invest in Spain, because I can't see the government acting on its own commitments to buy electric buses. Clearly, we need revenue in order to spend. And very clearly, the government has outlined the 4,000 buses that are coming sometime, but we're waiting and waiting and waiting. I think all three bus manufacturers in the UK have said that they have significant viability issues without those orders being placed. So my simple question is, how do we get a government to understand the urgency of acting now to stop new and important technologies from going overseas?
So I don't know the specifics about your particular situation and the company. I mean, I've heard of the company. I don't know what the specific drivers are in terms of your investment decision. We've been very clear about the direction of travel. We've also said in the heavy goods vehicle space, the batteries are one way of looking at it in terms of solving the decarbonisation problem, electricity, but also we're looking at hydrogen. So one of the things that we're doing and what people are doing is investing in hydrogen powered buses. I understand, I think in Aberdeen, we already have a fleet of hydrogen powered buses. So either of those technologies obviously work for us as far as decarbonisation is concerned. I'd be very happy to hear more about your calculations in terms of where you want to invest money. But my understanding is that the DfTE and the government is fully behind electric vehicles. I don't know where we are in terms of the procurement process, but I'd like to hear more and I'd be very happy for you to, as it were, take it offline and continue the conversation with you, because I need to know more specifics about your
Very good, Secretary of State. I'm of course delighted to follow up and also have the debate about where electricity fits and where hydrogen fits.
Exactly. So, people are championing different technologies, and the government is neutral between them, as it should be. We're looking at costs, we're looking at viability, we're also looking at the supply chain and that impact, and those are things that we should be considering.
Let's make sure, Andy, that we facilitate that conversation with you. As I say, we are going to do a whole one of these webinars with Alex Sharma about COP26, so I'll move on, and because I know that there are other subjects people want to talk about. Can we move on to Brexit? Look, you and I could disappear down a rabbit hole for years. And
we did.
And it's happened, and it's over, and I'm in therapy over it. So when you see a lot of the stuff that's going on at the moment with stuff stuck at borders and small businesses having problems, can you reassure people that this, and not just small businesses, some of the very big companies that we represent, can you reassure people that this really is just teething problems
I wouldn't put it as teething problems. I think there's an adjustment that needs to be made. But you will remember, all those 5 years that we debated this issue quite a great deal of intensity, there were all sorts of predictions that haven't proved true. Brexit hasn't, and also no one anticipated COVID either. So a lot of the Brexit issues are overlaid with this awful COVID situation. But what I do think is that we are going through a period of adjustment. We were in the EU, we were in the structures there for 48 years. Which, I don't know how old you are, but certainly longer than I've been alive. And most people had their careers, both civil servants, government people, business people, their entire careers were in the EU. there's very few people who remember the British economy before we went into the EU. So there was going to be a period of adjustment. We had a transition period, we got a deal, and now in the month two of leaving this organisation, I think there are problems. I mean, Bayes, people are being talked to, are being addressed because of the border issues. We're trying to deal with them. I think most of the problems are kind of COVID related in terms of the economy and the lockdown. But it would be wrong of me to just dismiss serious issues that small businesses present to me about rules of origin, about the border issues in Ireland, and also ports. But I think that a lot of the fears were exaggerated. I also think that the fact of the deal has made things a lot more certain with respect to Brexit than was the case only a few months ago. And I think we will get through the period. I hope we get through the lockdown and stop it. We will have a strong economic growth.
This isn't meant as an attack, but when you see the extent of the poison that happened, and lots of people on all sides bear blame for that, in Scotland, in terms of that, accelerating move toward independence. I mean, do you look back and go, maybe we should have just sidestepped this one at all?
I don't know how we were going to sidestep it. I mean, I think David Cameron was very brave and right to deal, confront with the issue head on. This is something that had been debated all my lifetime, the EU membership was an issue. I don't think it was going to go away. And even if we voted Remain, I think we will be all kind of, can you imagine if we'd stayed in the EU and there was a coronavirus bailout debate? I mean, that would have just been a completely disastrous situation politically and also medically and in terms of health. So either way we turned, this was going to be an issue. I think it has been resolved, more or less. But I agree. I think it's been a very time-consuming process, but I don't think there was any way of sidestepping it.
So one of the big debates during Brexit was about, deregulation, in an extreme form of that was that we could become big and poor. One of the first things you did, though, as Secretary of State, was to say, we're not going to look at employment rights. And then I look in the news today and I see Ian Duncan-Smith is chairing some committee to look at how we deregulate. And it's a bit confusing, really, because it seems to me that actually you have recognised that we don't really want to go here too much because it's going to cause too many problems. Frankly, if we look like we're cutting people's employment rights, that's going to cause all sorts of problems. But you still have true believers like Ian Duncan-Smith who are advising the government about deregulation. Which is it?
Look, I think, I don't know, I can't speak for Ian Duncan-Smith. All I could say is that I remember coming out of the Staines train station in my constituency at the time of the referendum, just before the vote, and a builder saying to me, I'm going to vote for Brexit. And I said, oh, that's interesting. Why are you going to do that? And his reason was that he hadn't had a wage increase for 15 years. Now, you might say that was the wrong motivation, blah, blah, blah. But the reason he, in his mind, was voting for Brexit was didn't want a reduction in wages or his working. So it always seemed odd to me that if we were going to vote for Brexit, we would then undermine workers' rights. That always seemed a very strange thing to do. And my real interest in terms of legislation wasn't about unpicking the stock of laws that we'd received on the 1st of January from the EU and that were on the statute book. I'm much more interested in the flow of legislation going forward, how we can adapt our economy to things like net zero, the challenge of net zero, levelling up, and those sorts of things. And ultimately, what I think is we want a high growth, high skilled, high productivity economy. We don't want a kind of sweatshop economy. And I was very, very clear about that. That's the message I've tried to drive home in my first few weeks.
So let's bring in Tim Jones, who's an executive director at Tata, which is obviously a very major business in India and in this country. So Tim, you've got a question on Brexit for the Secretary of State.
Thank you, Craig. Good morning, Secretary of State. Thank you very much for taking my question. I work for Tata and we have extensive interest in the UK, Jaguar Land Rover, steel, Tetley tea and a variety of other things. And we have a very close set of historic links, for obvious reasons, between India and the UK. Brexit has happened. And so my question really is, how do you see industrial strategy evolving in the UK as a result of Brexit, particularly, as you'd expect me to be interested in, issues around FDI, foreign direct investment?
So what we've done with FDI, to address that point specifically, is we've actually set up an office for investment, which my good friend and ministerial colleague here in Baines, Jerry Grimston, is setting up, and he's the head of that. And he's already visited the Gulf States. This is in the COVID restricted times, he's quarantined himself. But he's actually making those links as we speak. Similarly, I think Liz Truss, Liz Truss in DIT has been very front footed in terms of doing deals, and we're very, very forward leaning. I was delighted, obviously, with the Nissan deal, the Nissan investment commitment to the UK. I speak to Tata, as you know, a lot, and I'm engaged in conversations about steel production in Port Talbot, among other things. And I think, actually, if we look at the opportunity post-Brexit, I think there are lots and lots of people who want to invest in the UK. I was sorry to see that we were second last year, ahead behind France in terms of the inward investment, but that was the first time we'd come second in that polling for years. And I think a lot of that was to do with the Brexit uncertainty. Now I think we've turned the page largely on Brexit. This is one of the best opportunities we've had for driving international trade and attracting inward investment.
Thank you. The only thing I'd leave you with is the notion that while people know us as Tata, as a big industrial group, the core of our group actually now is an information business, TCS, AI and lots of other things around data.
I'd love to hear more about that, because you'll appreciate that most of my interaction, I remember from the Sajid Javid days, most of our interaction with the group was related to the steel industry. I'd be very interested to hear about your other activities.
Yeah, that sounds like a great conversation. We're coming towards the end of the call, and I want to move on to the final section that I want to talk to you about, Kwasi, is diversity and inclusion in ESG.
Absolutely right.
And it's been a massive issue for business since, really accentuated by killing of George Floyd in the States, and it's had a real knock-on. What I thought was extraordinary yesterday was this research which Trevor Phillips's business did yesterday, which pointed out that there isn't a single black leader in the top three positions in every single FTSE 100 business. It's terrible, isn't it?
Well, look, I think business has a long way to go to reflect the diversity and the range of talent in this country. And I see it a lot, actually. And one of the ironic things is that when I look at political leadership, when I look at the table at my cabinet colleagues, it's far more diverse than pretty much any board of a FTSE company. The kind of leadership, you could disagree with them, but people like Rishi Sunak, Sajid Javid, Priti Patel, myself, Suella Braverman, all of these people at the highest level of government, coming from families whose origins are outside, recent origins are outside the UK. And then you turn your gaze to top companies in the UK and you don't see that level of diversity. And it's not just about ethnic diversity. It's also, I think, about gender diversity as well. And you shake your head and think, how is that possible in 2021?
Is it government's job to give business a kick on?
I think government should be. I've always been resistant to actual quotas. I've always felt that was something that was perhaps a step too far. Because and the problem with it is that if you are a quota, someone who is benefiting in inverted commas from quotas, there's always a question mark as to whether you would have got there by merit. I've always been sceptical about that. But when you look at statistics like the one you described, it does beg the question. How else are we going to get change? And I think it's extraordinary to me how, and you see the same names coming up. I see this as a base Secretary of State, the same people getting put up to the same kinds of jobs. It's a very close circle. And I think it's actually damaging for the country, because I think you're shutting a lot of opportunity off and ability, and you're not necessarily always getting the best people. And we had this problem in the Conservative Party. We had this problem in the Conservative Party 20 years ago. I think David Cameron was really, really good on this, really strong.
It's an interesting point, because it's actually something that is remedied over decades, isn't it? And so that.
I think it can be remedied pretty quickly. I mean, if you look at the 2001 general, saying 20 years ago, it's a long time, but there were no ethnic Tory MPs before 2005. And 90% of the people in the Tory party as MPs were men. So there was no ethnic diversity, and there was very, very little gender diversity. Yeah, and that was in 2005. So the 2001 parliament ended in 2005. And it was only really in 2005 that we got people like Adam Afrié and Shailesh Vara coming into the parliamentary party. And as I said, I think David Cameron accelerated that. And now, 15 years later, we've got a situation where two of the top great officers of state are held by people whose origins are outside the UK. And we've got the most diverse cabinet ever. I think at my appointment, I was the first black MP ever to hold the post of Secretary of State. I mean, for all New Labour's vaunted diversity, they had Valerie Amos, who was a peer in the House of Lords. She hadn't been elected, and she was Secretary of State for about 6 months. So, you know, there has been a huge change. I think this government is more diverse than any other in British history. And I think in the corporate world, there's still a huge way to go to reach that level of diversity and a sense that, you know, a wide range of people can actually achieve great things.
Okay, we've got 5 minutes left, so let's get a couple of questions in again. So Sally Osman is former Director of Royal Communications at Buckingham Palace, and she's also a Teneo Senior Advisor. Sally, if you're there, I think you've got a question for Kwasi.
I have. Thank you very much, Craig, and good morning, Secretary of State. Don't worry, the question isn't about the history and value of a constitutional monarchy. It's really returning to the whole question of balance and priorities in the ESG field. I mean, it's a good thing that there's an increased focus on accountability within business for the whole ESG agenda, but how can government ensure that it doesn't become, that accountability doesn't become so mired in red tape and process that it actually inhibits businesses from delivering good outcomes? And then a sort of a supplementary question in some respects is about priorities. ESG covers such a broad swathe of activity. You've talked about the priority of net zero and the whole, that whole issue, but and touched on diversity, but what about everything else that is within the ESG bucket, not least employee welfare, for example, which is probably a big issue right now. So what's your advice to business in terms of prioritising those issues within the ESG framework?
Look, that's a vast question. I mean, it's like asking someone, you know, who's your favourite child? You know, it's a very different, I mean, all of these things are hugely important. I think that net zero is critically important because of climate change, and I think we're very rigorously focused on that. I think diversity and inclusion, as you mentioned, and I touched on, is also very important. And I think that you know, employee rights, employees' mental health is very important. But asking me to rank them in terms of which is more important than the other, I probably prioritise climate change because I think it's an immediate threat that cuts across nations and everybody in the world. But to rank these things and say that one is more important than the other, I think is an unfair question.
Okay, we've got 2 minutes left, so I'm going to get Alistair Smith, who's the Director of Strategic Communications at EY, if you come into vision, Alistair, and it'd be great to get your question for Kwasi.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Craig. Secretary of State, it may be unfair to try and get you to do this in a couple of minutes, but I'm keen to understand your view on whether, you know, following on from the vast level of government support for business during COVID-19 and the clear demonstration there's been of the reliance employees, customers, suppliers, etc. have on companies, you feel that there's an opportunity to look at the contract between society and business, and, you know, accelerate change in corporate governance, link that more closely to sustainability, and I dare say you kind of accelerate some idea of inclusive or stakeholder capitalism?
Look, I think you ask an excellent question, and it's a very broad one, and I can answer it directly. Yes. What I would say is that the world of 2021, completely different world that we grew up in the 80s, the 90s, and the 2000s. And I think that there is scope, and I spoke to the Prime Minister about this, trying to almost reset, redefine what a modern capitalist country, a modern, you know, free market driven economy looks like. I think the whole issue, I mean, as a historian, someone who's fascinated by history of ideas and industrialization, I think that a lot of the language around workers' rights, around you know, capitalism, a lot of that derives from a 19th century view of industrial relations, where essentially you have workers on the one hand who are being exploited crudely, being exploited by capitalists on the other. The way in which the welfare state has evolved, the way in which modern government has evolved, the way in which modern business has evolved, has left that model, I think, largely behind. And I think there is scope for trying to rethink, you know, how a modern economy is organized across every, you know, government, politics, the economy, the environment. There's a full range of things which we have to rethink now. In the last half a minute, I can't possibly, yeah, you know, define.
Absolutely.
Probably people will write endless books about it. But there's definitely a moment where I think, you know, we need to think very broadly and very rigorously about the kind of society that we're entering into.
Well, listen, thank you very much for that question, Alistair. And Kwasi, I just wanted to say thank you. Yeah, and thank you so much for joining us. I know how busy you are, but I also know how much you want to engage with business. And I think everybody on this call, we've had well over 200 people who've been involved, will really appreciate the fact that you've shown up today and that you've answered their questions. I know that you've said that you really want to engage and meet with people. People, and so I know going forward you will be doing that, but I'm going to let you go to your next meeting, and in the meantime, thank you very much. And
thanks, Craig.
There's a round of applause going on right now, Kwasi, and
very interesting. Very interesting. Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Thank you, everybody.